Okay, okay, Ray said, throwing up his hands. I'll try to answer your questions, but first, you need to take a deep breath and calm down a little bit, all right? Fuck calming down! I shouted, straining against my safety harness. And fuck you too, Ray, you lying sack of shit! Tell me what's going on, or I'll lose it, I swear! Okay, he said, in a soothing voice. But first, I need you to breathe, Zach. He studied my face anxiously. I realized then that I did not, in fact, appear to be breathing. So I took a deep, gasping breath, then exhaled slowly. I felt a little better then, and my breathing began to normalize. Ray nodded, satisfied. Good, he said. Thank you. Now, go ahead and ask your questions again, one at a time, and I'll do my best to answer them if I can. Where the hell did this shuttle come from? Who built it? Isn't that obvious? He said. The Earth Defense Alliance built it. He nodded at his two companions. And to answer your earlier question, these two men are EDA field agents, here to ensure your safe transport. No way, I said. There's no way the EDA can be real. It's real, he said. The Earth Defense Alliance is a top-secret global military coalition formed over 4 decades ago.
Formed to do what?
To defend Earth, I suppose? He nodded. Hence the name.
To defend it from what?
I wanted to hear him say it out loud. From an alien invasion. I studied Ray's face for any hint of irony, but his expression was now gravely serious. I glanced at his two companions to gauge their reaction, but they didn't even seem to be listening to our conversation. Both of them had taken out smartphones and were studying their displays. I looked back at Ray.
An alien invasion? By who? The Sobrakai? Evil humanoid squids from Tau Ceti? You're going to tell me they're real, too?
No, not exactly, he said. The Sobrakai are fictional, invented by Chaos Terrain to serve as the alien antagonists in their video games. But, as you're probably now realizing, Armada and Terra Firma aren't just games. They are simulators designed for a very specific purpose, to train citizens all over this planet to operate the drones that will defend it.
Defend it from who? You just said the Sobrakai aren't real.
They aren't, he said. But they're stand-ins for a real alien threat, whose existence had to be kept secret until now to prevent global panic. He gave me an odd smile. The name Sobrakai is actually a play on the word sobriquet, which is just a fancy term for nickname. Sneaky, eh?
A terrible thought occurred to me. Yesterday morning, I was sure I saw a Glaive fighter.
That was the real deal, he said. You spotted a real enemy scout ship. EDA intel says a bunch of them have been spotted over the past 24 hours all over the world. We think they're conducting surveillance on all of our hardline intranet nodes.
But it looked exactly like a Sobrakai Glaive.
Of course it did, he said. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Chaos Terrain modeled all of the Sobrakai's forces after our real enemy. They recreated their ships and drones as accurately as possible inside the sim, in the games, to make them as realistic as possible.
So, these aliens, they really have Glaive fighters? And Wyverns?
And Dreadnought Spheres, Spider Fighters, Basilisks, they all really exist, he said. Chaos Terrain made up those names, but everything else about the enemy's drones and armada is completely accurate. Their appearance, weaponry, maneuverability, tactics, and strategy, all were based on direct observations of our real enemy's forces and technology, made during our previous engagements with them.
Previous engagements? I asked. How long have we been fighting them? Where are they from? What do they look like? When did they make first contact? If...
He held up a hand to cut me off, sensing the hysteria creeping back into my voice. I can't tell you any of that yet, he said. The information we've gathered on the enemy is still classified. He checked his watch. But not for very much longer. You'll be fully briefed as soon as we reach Nebraska.
Nebraska? I said. What's in Nebraska?
A top-secret Earth Defense Alliance base. I opened my mouth to reply, then closed it again. Then I repeated this process a few more times until I actually managed to form words again.
You said the EDA was formed over 4 decades ago.
So we've known this alien invasion was coming for that long?
He nodded.
Since the mid-70s, he said. That was when the EDA first began using certain elements of pop culture to subliminally prepare the world's population for the invasion. That's why the EDA secretly poured billions into the fledgling video game industry back then. They recognized its potential military training applications. He smiled. They helped get Star Wars made back in 1977 for pretty much the same reason.
Pardon me?
Ray held up 3 fingers, Scout's Honor. I didn't believe it either when I first found out, but it's true. Star Wars was one of the first movie projects the EDA helped finance, because their think tanks told them its unique subject matter could help the war effort. George Lucas never even found out about it. He always thought Alan Ladd Jr. deserved all the credit for greenlighting Star Wars. But in reality, the EDA put up a large chunk of the budget through a bogus network of film and television financing companies that could never be traced back to...
Hold on. You're telling me that Star Wars was secretly financed by the Earth Defense Alliance to serve as anti-alien propaganda?
He nodded. That's a gross oversimplification, but yeah, more or less.
I thought about the timeline my father had made in his old journal. What about all the other science fiction movies and shows released over the past 40 years? I asked. You're telling me they were all created as anti-alien propaganda too?
Of course not, he said. Not all of them. Just certain key properties, like Star Wars, which played a key role in the militarization of science fiction films, TV shows, and video games in the late 70s. Space Invaders came out the year after Star Wars was released, and humanity has been fighting off video game aliens ever since. Now you know why. The EDA made sure of it.
Bullshit.
It's true, he said. All of the recent Star Trek reboots and Star Wars sequels were a key part of the final wave of the EDA's subliminal preparation of the world's population. I doubt that Viacom, Disney, or J.J. Abrams ever knew what was really going on, or who was pulling the strings.
I was quiet for a long time as I took all of this in. Why didn't you ever tell me about any of this? I finally asked. He gave me a sad smile.
Sorry about that, Zach, he said. It wasn't up to me.
That suddenly drove it home. I had known this man for over 6 years, and that entire time he had been lying to me, probably about everything, including his identity. Who are you? Is Ray Wierzbowski even your real name?
Actually, no, he said. My real name is Raymond Habishaw. I borrowed Wierzbowski from one of the Colonial Marines in Aliens.
I mentioned that once, and you told me it was a fucking coincidence.
He shrugged and looked sheepish. It made me want to strangle him. I was given a new identity when the EDA stationed me in Beaverton in the first place. To keep an eye on you.
To keep an eye on me? Why?
Why do you think? He said. You possess a very rare and valuable talent, Zach. The EDA has been tracking and profiling you ever since you first played a video game online. That's why I was assigned to watch over you and to help facilitate your training. He grinned. You know, sort of like Obi-Wan watching over Luke while he was growing up on Tatooine.
You're a bold-faced liar like Obi-Wan, too, I shot back. That's for sure.
Ray's smile vanished, and his eyes narrowed. And you're being a whiny little bitch, just like Luke. The other two EDA agents snickered. They were apparently listening after all. I shot them a glare and they conspicuously returned their attention to their smartphones. I glanced down at the devices they were holding, wondering how they were even getting a signal up here. Each phone was slightly larger and thicker than a normal mobile phone, and hinged so that it opened like a portable gaming console. One of the agents appeared to be playing a game of some kind on his, but I couldn't see his display well enough to tell what it was. I looked back up at Ray. "Listen, I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean that. I just thought you'd be a little more appreciative, that's all. Do you think I enjoyed living in Beaverton all this time?" Now I was beginning to understand. Ray had spent the past 6 years of his life stuck with what soldiers referred to as a shit detail, trapped behind the counter of a used video game shop in a desolate suburban strip mall with nothing to do but watch me play Armada, listen to all of my pointless adolescent bitching, or pass the time by ranting to me about alien abductions and government cover-ups. All of his X-Files-inspired alien conspiracy rants over the years had probably been his own way of trying to psychologically prepare me for the truth whenever the EDA finally decided that I deserved to hear it, which was right now, evidently, at the last possible fucking moment. Of course, the truth, or at least some of it, had already been revealed to me years ago, back when I'd first read my father's journal. I'd just been incapable of believing it. That led me to finally ask the question I'd been working up the courage to ask ever since I'd first boarded the shuttle. Was my father ever recruited by the Earth Defense Alliance? He let out a sigh, as if he'd been waiting for this question and dreading it. "I honestly don't know," he said. Before I could call him a liar again, he went on. "I'm telling you the truth, so just hold on now and listen to me." He took a deep breath. "This isn't about your father, Zach. Try to understand what's happening, what's at stake. The entire future of the human race. Just answer me. I read his journal. He knew about the EDA. He was starting to figure out what they were and what they were up to right before he died in some bizarre on-the-job accident. So what really happened? Did the EDA have him killed to keep him quiet?" Ray was silent for what seemed like an eternity, but it may have only been a second. "I told you, I don't know what happened to your father," he said. "I'm a lowly field agent with equally low security clearance." He held up a finger to keep me from interrupting him again. "Here's what I do know. The EDA does have a file on him in their database, but it's classified, and I've never been able to access it. So I don't know what his connection was to the EDA, if there was one at all. But the EDA wasn't created to murder people. It was formed to save them." I was hyperventilating now. "Please, Ray," I heard myself say. "You know how important this is to me." "Yes, I do," he said. "That's why you need to pull yourself together right now and focus. Otherwise, you'll ruin any chance to find out what they know about your father." "What do you mean? What chance?" "You're being transported to an enlistment briefing," he said. "Afterward, you'll be offered the opportunity to enlist in the Earth Defense Alliance. But if you take it, you'll be made a flight officer," he said, continuing to talk over me, "and then you'll outrank me." He looked me directly in the eyes. "You'll also have a higher security clearance than I do. You might be able to access your father's file." Ray seemed about to say something more when a boom shook the entire shuttle. I felt a rush of panic, thinking we'd just come under attack. Then I realized we'd just broken the sound barrier. "Hold on to your seat," Ray said, taking his own advice. "We're about to go suborbital." Dozens of questions were still ricocheting around in my head, but I managed to put them out of my mind, at least for the moment. Then I forced myself to sit back and try to enjoy the rest of this surreal ride I now found myself on. This was a smart move, because I was about to make my first trip into space. Phase 2. All war is deception. Sun Tzu. 8. I clutched my jump seat's armrests, watching anxiously as the cobalt blue sky outside the shuttle's porthole windows darkened to a deep shade of indigo, then on to pitch black just a few heartbeats later. We were at the edge of space.
the boundary I'd dreamed of crossing my entire life. I'd never really believed I'd get the chance to do it during my lifetime, let alone today when I should have been in my first period civics class. I strained against my safety harness and craned my neck toward the curved window, trying to take in the entire radiant blue curve of Earth now visible beyond it. The sight was overwhelming and made the little kid inside of me involuntarily whisper, "Wow." Unfortunately, he must have whispered it out loud, because Ray was now staring at me with the same amused smirk he gave me every time he schooled me in a terra firma deathmatch. I nearly flipped in the bird out of force of habit. Some thick part of my brain still thought Ray was my boss and friend. We were only in low Earth orbit for a minute. I kept waiting for the gravity to cut out, right up until the shuttle reached its apogee. No such luck. I still felt no indication that we were even moving, not even when we began to fall back to Earth, and the blackness outside my window returned to a deep, dark blue and continued to grow lighter in hue every second until daylight flooded in again. We sliced down through another dense layer of clouds, and suddenly the ground was rushing upward in a terrifying blur of speed. But then, in the space of a few seconds, we decelerated to a dead stop. I felt momentarily nauseous, but only because my eyes and my body were sending my brain conflicting information about whether or not I was in motion. When I recovered a second later, I looked back out the window. Directly below us was a large white ranch house, flanked by several barns and outbuildings, and a long row of tower grain silos topped with steel domes that glinted in the morning sun, like rockets waiting to be launched. The farm was surrounded on all sides by a vast sea of fields and rolling green hills and prairies, broken only by a single dirt road that snaked away across the northern horizon. I also spotted three other EDA shuttles drifting in the sky around us, all descending on a course similar to our own. As our shuttle continued its descent, one of the plowed fields adjacent to the farm collapsed in on itself, like a perfectly rectangular sinkhole, then split in two and slid apart, like two massive elevator doors set into the earth. They revealed an enormous circular shaft leading deep underground, like an empty missile silo, but much larger in diameter. The blue runway lights that lined its curved concrete walls pulsed in sequence as they receded into the depths below, guiding our shuttle down into the darkness. "The EDA has bases like this one hidden all over the world," Ray said. "Some are in remote, unpopulated areas like this one, but we also have hidden drone caches and control bunkers located throughout every major city." "Just like in Armada," I said, "and Terra Firma." Ray nodded. "Everything is hidden in plain sight," he pointed below us. "Those outbuildings actually conceal the entrance of an underground infantry drone bunker, and those grain silos are camouflaged interceptor launch tunnels. Amazing, eh? It's astounding how much the EDA has accomplished while working in secret all these years." I nodded, still trying to rein in my conflicting emotions. Everything I'd ever been told or taught about the state of the world had been a lie. I'd grown up believing that, despite our aspirations, humans were still just a bunch of bipedal apes, divided into arbitrary tribes that were constantly at war over their ruined planet's dwindling natural resources. I'd always assumed that our future would end up looking more like Mad Max than Star Trek. But now I was forced to see our rampant fossil fuel consumption and our seeming disregard for its effect on our already changing climate in an entirely new light. We hadn't used up all of our oil and ravaged our planet in a mindless pursuit of consumerism, but in preparation for a dark day that most of us hadn't even known was coming. Even humanity's lack of concern for its rampant overpopulation problem now made a terrible kind of sense. What difference did it make if our planet was capable of supporting all 7 billion of us in the long term when a far greater threat to our numbers was waiting in the wings? And despite the overwhelming odds, humanity had done what was necessary to ensure its own survival. It filled me with a strange new sense of pride in my own species. We weren't a bunch of primitive monkeys teetering on the brink of self-destruction after all. This appeared to be an altogether different kind of destruction we were teetering on the brink of. Our shuttle was racing down the tunnel now, blurring the lights embedded in its walls into strobing neon bands as we plunged deep underground. When we reached the bottom of the shaft a few seconds later, it widened into an enormous subterranean hangar with a large circular runway that was now spread out below us. Our shuttle landed at its northern edge, joining a long line of identical EDA tactical shuttles parked along the runway's glowing perimeter. As soon as the doors slid open, Ray unbuckled his harness, jumped out onto the runway, and motioned for me to follow. My fingers fumbled with the latch of my safety harness for a few seconds, then I finally slipped free of it. After I tested my legs to make sure they were both still working, I climbed outside to join Ray. The pilot and the other two EDA agents remained on board. Like an idiot, I awkwardly waved goodbye to them just before the shuttle doors closed again with a pneumatic hiss. I checked the time on my phone and saw that the trip here from Beaverton had taken less than 20 minutes. I also noticed that I wasn't getting a signal down here, which meant I wouldn't be able to call my mom and tell her I was all right. Suddenly, I wanted very badly to hear her voice. Had the school called her yet? What had they told her? She had to be going crazy with worry right now. Earlier that morning, when I'd stumbled downstairs, she'd surprised me with dinner for breakfast waiting on the kitchen table. Her monstrous meatloaf and mashed potatoes, my absolute favorite. She'd watched me stuff my face, grinning from ear to ear, and pausing every few minutes to tell me to slow down and chew my food. I'd given her a quick kiss on the cheek and rushed out the door, worried that she might decide to revisit the dreaded subject of my academic future at any moment. She'd called out, "I love you," and I'd mumbled it back to her as I continued hurrying out to my car. Had she heard me? I felt like kicking myself for not making sure. "Welcome to Crystal Palace," Ray said. "That's the EDA's code name for this place." "Why?" I asked. He shook his head. "Because it's easier to say than Earth Defense Alliance Strategic Command Post Number 14, he said. "Sounds cooler, too." As we stepped away from the shuttle, I took in my new surroundings. Hundreds of people were hurrying around the runway in what appeared to be a state of highly organized chaos. Most of them wore Earth Defense Alliance combat fatigues like our shuttle pilot, and I found myself wondering if I was going to be issued a uniform, too. I heard a rush of air over our heads and looked up to see a procession of four more shuttles descending through the entry shaft. As each one set down on the runway and discharged its passengers, other civilians like me emerged, escorted by one or more EDA agents wearing dark suits. Most of them appeared to be holding it together pretty well. A few of them looked terrified, like lambs being led to the slaughter, but the vast majority appeared to be having the time of their lives. I took quick stock of my own emotions, and I decided I fell somewhere in the middle. There was a loud whoosh behind us as our shuttle lifted off again, and Ray and I turned to watch it slowly rise and then rocket back up through the circular shaft to the surface. "Follow me, pal," Ray said, before striding off toward a pair of large armored doors set into the stone wall at the opposite end of the runway. They were already sliding open to reveal a broad, downward-sloping corridor that led even farther underground. I stopped and called out to Ray, who turned and walked back to me as the other agents and recruits began to stream past us, continuing through the massive armored doors. "What if I decide I don't want to enlist?" I asked. "What if I sit through this big briefing of yours and then decide I want to go back home?" Ray smiled, as if he'd been waiting for me to ask this too. "Then I would remind you, Zachary Ulysses Lightman, that you are an 18-year-old citizen of the United States of America, and therefore legally subject to military conscription." This possibility hadn't occurred to me. "Wait, so I'm being drafted right now?" "Not really," Ray said. "No one's going to force you to fight.
If you still want to go home after the briefing, just say the word. They'll put you on another shuttle to take you straight back to Beaverton, a first-class seat on the Chicken Shit Express. I didn't respond. I was already too busy nursing my wounded pride. I know you, Zach, Ray said. You've been waiting your whole life for something like this to happen. Something important. Something meaningful. A dare-to-be-great situation, right? He took me by the shoulders. Well, this is it, Ace. The universe has given you a chance to use your gifts to help save the world. Do you really expect me to believe that you're going to pass it up to run home, sit on your ass, and watch the end of the world on TV? Ray let go of me and set off again. His footsteps echoed off the high stone walls as he passed through the open doors and down into the corridor beyond, disappearing from view. I took one last look up at the tiny circle of sky still visible through the open shaft entrance high overhead. Then I ran after Ray. The entrance corridor led down to a security checkpoint, where a uniformed EDA corporal named Foyle scanned my handprints and retinas to verify my identity, then stood me in front of a blue screen to snap a digital photo of my face. A few seconds later, the printer behind him spat out a photo ID badge with a holographic EDA crest on it, which he handed to me. Printed beneath my picture were my full name, social security number, and the words Elite Recruit Candidate. As I clipped it onto my shirt, the corporal handed another badge to Ray. It had an old photo of Ray on it, along with Sergeant Raymond Habishaw, field operative. I wondered why our call signs weren't printed on our badges, but then it occurred to me that the EDA probably didn't want any of its recruits walking around with handles like More DACA or Percy Jackoff 69 printed onto their official identification cards. Corporal Foyle reached under the counter and handed me a small handheld device that resembled an extra-thick smartphone, the same sort of device I'd seen Ray and his two companions using during the shuttle ride here. The device was inside a protective case with a thick Velcro wrist strap attached to the back, which the corporal used to fasten the device to my right forearm like an oversized wristwatch. "This is your QCOM," he explained. "It's a quantum communicator, basically a smartphone with unlimited range. It will work anywhere in the world or in outer space." He smiled. "They also have insanely fast internet access and Bluetooth capability. I already imported all your contacts, photos, and music from your iPhone, so you're all set up." I pulled my iPhone from the front pocket of my jeans. It still had no signal, and the battery was about to die. "How the hell were you able to do that?" "Don't worry," the corporal said, ignoring my question. "Your QCOM is far more secure and versatile." He tapped its display. "It's like an iPhone, a tricorder, and a small laser pistol all rolled into one device." "Whoa, seriously?" I unsnapped it from my wrist to examine it more closely. "Yeah," Foyle said, smiling proudly. "I'm sort of like Q in the James Bond films, except, you know, I only get to hand out this one thing." I turned the QCOM over in my palm, trying to accept that I was holding a piece of reverse-engineered alien technology. I tapped the touchscreen, and it lit up, displaying a large collection of icons. Email, internet, GPS, and what looked like a normal phone dialer, along with other applications I didn't recognize. "Can I call home with this?" I asked. "Not yet," the corporal replied. "Your QCOM's outside phone and internet access will remain disabled until the big news goes public later today. But you're already connected to the EDA's quantum network, so you can call any other QCOM in existence, if you have its contact code. Your code is printed on the back of the case." I flipped it over in my hands and saw a 10-digit number etched onto the case. Ray pulled out his own QCOM and touched the edge of his device to mine. I heard a soft electronic ding, and Ray's name and number appeared on my QCOM's contact list. "Now you can call me anytime, from anywhere," he said. "Even from the opposite side of the galaxy." He laughed an unsettling little laugh. "Not that it's likely to happen." I gazed down at the QCOM. It was hinged along one side, like a flip phone, and it opened up into what looked like a portable gaming device, with another display screen on top and a game controller beneath it, with two thumb pads and six-lettered buttons. "What? Can I play Sonic the Hedgehog on this thing, too?" "Actually, yes," Foyle said. "Your QCOM also doubles as a portable drone control platform.
In emergency situations, it can be used to control an interceptor, an Aethid, or any of our other drones. He lowered his voice, as if imparting a secret.
They're a real bitch to use, though. Take a lot of practice.
Still leaning forward conspiratorially, the corporal whispered,
Each one also has a built-in weirding module.
He raised his own QCOM and crossed his wrists as he held it out in front of him.
By using sound and motion, you will be able to paralyze nerves, shatter bones, set fires, suffocate an enemy, or burst his organs.
I laughed out loud. That's the first weirding module joke I've ever heard, I said. Bravo! There were no weirding modules in the original Dune books, you know, Ray muttered, shaking his head. David Lynch made that shit up. So what, Ray? I said, feeling like we were back at the store. They're cool as hell. I'm not saying it makes up for that super creepy heart plug scene. Foyle was seemingly all business again. You should be all set, he said. Your QCOM's laser is currently disabled, but your commanding officer will activate it after you enlist. If I enlist, I said. They still haven't even told me who or what is invading us. Right, he said, shooting Ray a surprised look. Anyway, the laser will drain your battery after 3 or 4 shots, so if you have to use it, try to do so sparingly. Got it, I told the corporal. So I'm all set? Yes, sir, he replied. Good to go. We all saluted each other again instead of waving goodbye. Then the corporal remained at attention as we walked out of sight. I followed Ray through a pair of automatic doors into another downward-sloping hallway. Why didn't the EDA introduce all of this new technology into the mainstream? I asked, studying the QCOM on my wrist. Ultra-fast travel, quantum, communication? It seems like that would have given a boost to the global economy and the war effort. Our scientists spent decades reverse-engineering all of this alien technology, but they've only managed to perfect it in the last few years, he said. I think the EDA would have gradually released it into the mainstream if there'd been enough time. We passed through 2 more security checkpoints, then proceeded down a long tubular corridor with lots of smaller corridors branching off of it, each lined with numbered doors spaced just a few feet apart. I was just about to ask Ray what was behind them when one hissed open and a female EDA officer emerged. Before the door closed behind her, I caught a glimpse of a tiny closet-sized room. In its center was a rotating chair bolted to the floor, surrounded by an array of ergonomic control panels and game controllers, along with a wraparound monitor displaying a first-person cockpit view from inside a giant EDA war mech. Drone controller stations, Ray said, following my gaze. There are thousands of them located throughout the base. Each one can be used to remote pilot an interceptor, an Aethid, or any other drone in the EDA's arsenal, with no lag and no range limitations.
You mean real drones?
Real ones. He pointed behind me. Here come a few right now. I turned to see a column of 10 Aethids marching down the corridor toward us. I stood frozen as the robots lumbered by, joints clanking and servos whining. By the time they rounded the corner and vanished, Ray was already moving again, and I hurried to catch up, still trying to get my bearings.
Lieutenant Lightman?
A male voice called out. Ray and I both stopped and turned around to confront the voice's owner. He was just a kid, even younger than me, with dark brown skin, hair, and eyes. There were captain's bars on his lapel, and an Iranian flag was stitched onto the shoulder of his uniform. The young man held up a QCOM and appeared to scan my face with it. Then an enormous smile appeared on his face when he saw my name appear on its display. He abruptly snapped to attention and saluted me.
It's such an honor to finally meet you in person, he said. Captain Arjang Dog at your service. I'm a huge fan of your work, Lieutenant.
My work? I repeated, glancing over at Ray uncertainly. Lieutenant? Sorry, sir, Ray said, returning Dog's salute. Mr. Lightman here hasn't been sworn in yet.
Of course, he said. I knew that. He grinned apologetically. Sorry for stalking you with my QCOM, Mr. Lightman, but I've always wanted to meet you.
He began to shake my hand and didn't stop.
The two of us have flown dozens of missions together over the years, so you might recognize my call sign.
He put out his hand. I shook his hand as firmly as I could.
I'm Rostam. My smile faltered, and I let go of his hand. I recognized the name, all right.
Wow, really? I said, trying to recover by mustering a fake grin.
It's great to finally meet you.
I always assumed I was the youngest pilot in the top 10.
That honor appears to be mine, he said, flashing me an infuriatingly humble smile. Then he turned to address Ray.
I'm currently ranked 5th, he said. The Iron Beagle here is in 6th.
He smiled back at me. But that's a recent development. For a long time, I was chasing your tail.
You deserve to be in the top 5, I said, trying to hide how much his compliments were irking me. You've trounced me on the player versus player servers more than once. You're an ace, man. Elite.
Very kind of you to say, he replied. That means a lot coming from you.
Ray cleared his throat impatiently and pointed to his non-existent watch. Captain Dog gave him a perturbed glare, then jerked a thumb at the captain's bars on his lapel.
Chillax, Sergeant, Dog said. The grown-ups are talking.
When Dog turned back to face me, Ray reached out and mimed, snapping his neck.
Yes, sir, Captain, sir.
Dog smiled at me again. Then he produced a glossy 8x10 photo from a plastic folder stuffed under his arm. It was a photo of me, an enlarged version of the one they'd just taken from my ID badge. He held it out to me sheepishly, along with a black felt-tip pen.
Would you mind terribly signing this?
He asked.
I'm trying to collect autographs from all of the other pilots in the top 10, and I figured this might be my only chance to get yours.
I ignored the ominous subtext of what he'd just said, and then used his pen to sign my first ever autograph. Then I handed the photo back to Doc, wondering how many other Armada pilot autographs he'd collected so far today, and from whom.
Thank you so much, Mr. Lightman, Doc said. Like I said, it was an honor.
He started to salute me again, then stuck out his hand instead. We shook.
The honor was all mine, sir, I said. I hope we run into each other again.
He reached out and touched his QCOM to mine. Both devices beeped.
I added my QCOM number to your contact list, he said. Don't hesitate to call me if I can help you with anything.
I won't, I said. Thanks.
He turned and hurried off in another direction.
Once he was out of sight, Ray and I continued walking. We passed through another set of automatic armored doors.
How old was that kid?
Who, Captain Dog? He said. 17? But he was only 15 when the EDA first recruited him. He's a prodigy, though.
He stopped walking and gave me a nervous glance.
Not to imply that you weren't, or aren't.
I felt like I'd just been picked last for the world's biggest game of kickball.
I was ranked in the top 10, too, I said. Why wasn't I recruited at age 15?
He frowned and gave me an incredulous look.
Your psych profile indicated you weren't suitable for early recruitment.
Why not? Why wasn't I suitable?
Don't play dumb, Zack Attack, he said. You know why.
Before I could respond, Ray turned his back on me and continued walking. But before he could get out of sight, I swallowed my pride and hurried after him. Eventually, we arrived in a circular lobby containing a large bank of elevators. There were already several other elite recruit candidates milling around, waiting for the next car to arrive. I was about to walk over and join them when Ray tapped me on the shoulder.
This is as far as I go, he said. Then he looked me up and down, as if he were sending me off to my first day of school.
He reached for my backpack, which was now mostly empty, and I handed it to him. Then, before I could protest, he slipped my father's jacket off of me and began to fold it up.
Hey, that's mine, I said, hating how much I sounded like an angry child.
Yeah, I know, he said, and it's a very cool jacket, no argument. But wearing it into this briefing won't help you make the best first impression.
He stuffed the jacket into my backpack and forced the zipper closed, then put the pack back on my shoulders.
Those elevators will take you down to the briefing auditorium, he said, pointing behind me. Just follow those other recruit candidates.
I glanced across the lobby, over at the recruits forming a line at the elevators. Then I turned back to face Ray.
When will I see you again?
I'm not sure, pal, he said, meeting my gaze. Things are happening very fast now. I'm departing on another shuttle in just a few minutes.
Why? I asked. Where are they sending you?
To help defend the Big Apple, he said. I'm one of the 30 dozen, remember?
He smiled and straightened his posture, then his lapels.
I've been assigned to the EDA's 1st Armored Drone Battalion, he said. We'll be defending the Eastern Seaboard, so I'll be down here fighting them on the ground, while you're up there fighting them in the sky.
We stood there in silence for a moment. Then Ray stuck out his hand. I hesitated for a moment, but then I shook it. In spite of everything, I still didn't want Ray to leave. He was the only familiar face in this place. While I was fumbling for a way to say goodbye to him without expressing any hint of forgiveness, Ray surprised me by throwing his arms around me in a fierce bear hug. Then I surprised myself by hugging him back just as tightly.
You've got a gift, Zach, he said, stepping back. You really can make a difference in this war. Remember that, okay? No matter how frightening things get in these next few hours.
I nodded, but didn't reply. I had absolutely no idea how to respond to that, or to anything that was happening right now. I wasn't a soldier. I was just a kid from the suburbs who played a shitload of video games. I wasn't prepared to fight an interplanetary war. At the moment, I didn't feel prepared for much of anything. Not even to say goodbye to Ray.
Okay, let's not make it a scene, Ray said. Take care of yourself for me, okay? And...
His voice caught. He cleared his throat and went on.
And when this is all over, let's make a pact to meet back at Starbase Ace. We'll order some TIE fighter takeout and swap war stories. Deal?
Deal, I said, around the lump rising in my throat. Ray saluted me, and I saluted him back, even though I felt like a kid playing soldier.
The Force will be with you, Ray said, giving my shoulder one last squeeze. Always.
That was it. He turned and walked off, disappearing back the way we came. I stood for a moment, staring after him. Then I glanced back over at the bank of elevators, where my fellow elite recruit candidates continued to form an anxious queue. 9. I filed into an elevator with 15 other recruits. They varied drastically in age, gender, and ethnicity, but all of them wore a variation of the same dazed expression, which I knew was probably also mirrored on my own face. As the elevator descended, we all stood there in silence, staring at the ceiling, our shoes, or at the closed doors in front of us, anything to avoid making eye contact. I wondered where each of them had been and what they'd been doing earlier that morning when an Earth Defense Alliance shuttle had appeared out of nowhere to shatter their notion of reality, yank them out of their lives, and bring them here. I also found myself wondering if I'd ever played Terra Firma or Armada with any of these people. It seemed possible, even probable. Hell, for all I knew, one of the people beside me could be the famed Red Jive in the flesh. The elevator car had no floor indicator or control panel, just a single down arrow that lit up and beeped about twice every second as the car descended deeper and deeper below ground. I counted over 20 of those beeps before the doors finally opened again. We stepped off the elevator into a large circular lobby that was already clogged with a procession of disoriented recruit candidates like ourselves. Most were dressed in their normal street clothes like me, but for a wide variety of different climates. I also spotted people in business suits, fast food uniforms, surgical scrubs, and one dazed-looking middle-aged woman who was wearing a wedding dress and still clutching her bridal bouquet. A line of EDA soldiers stationed around the lobby herded everyone through a long row of doors into the adjacent sunken auditorium. As I filed into it with the others, I swiveled my head around to survey the layout.
The enormous bowl-shaped auditorium had stadium-style seating that faced an enormous curved projection screen, making it look more like an IMAX theater than a top-secret underground briefing room. But the ceiling was a different story. It was a long, sloping grid of concrete waffle slabs, each reinforced with shock absorption springs at its center. Like the rest of the base, the auditorium looked as if it had been built to withstand a direct nuclear blast on the surface above. I swept my gaze around the auditorium, trying to decide where I should sit. At the foot of the giant screen, I noticed a low rectangular stage with a podium at its center. The first 30 or so rows in front of it were already filled with nervous recruits, and a steady stream of new ones were filing in and filling up the rows behind them, one after another, the way we did at school assemblies. But a few dozen less conformist, or more antisocial, individuals had chosen to sit much farther back, either by themselves or in scattered small groups. I began to climb the nearest staircase, heading for the least populated seats in the upper third of the auditorium. Once I reached the nosebleed section, I began to look for a sufficiently isolated seat. Then I froze in mid-step. She was just off to my right, sitting all alone in a deserted row near the back, taking brazen pulls from a chrome hip flask painted to look like R2-D2. Even seated, I could tell she must be a few inches taller than me. Her pale alabaster skin contrasted sharply with her dark clothing, black combat boots, black jeans, and a black tank top, which didn't fully conceal the black bra she was wearing underneath. She had a spiky wave of black hair that was buzzed down one side and chin length on the other. But the real kicker was her tattoos on each arm. On the left was a beautiful semi-nude rendering of the comic book heroine Tank Girl, adorned in post-apocalyptic rock lingerie and smooching an M16. On her right bicep, in stylized capital letters, were the words, "El riesgo siempre vive." Seeing her was almost as jarring as when I'd first glimpsed that glaive fighter the previous afternoon. I had fallen for Ellen gradually over a period of months. But this was like taking a lightning bolt from Mjolnir straight to the forehead. I was still wondering if I had the courage to go sit near her when I realized I was already moving in that direction, as fast as my feet would carry me. As I climbed the stairs, it occurred to me that my emotions were probably not to be trusted under these heightened circumstances, but that thought was lost amid the influx of hormones flooding my brain as I made my way to the center of the row where she was sitting. I tried to convince myself that she looked like she could use some company, even though everything about her demeanor indicated the opposite. When I reached her seat, she ignored me, leaving me standing there, waiting for her to acknowledge my existence. As she continued to stare at her lap, I looked down at what was holding her attention and saw that she'd cracked open her QCOM and had its electronic innards arrayed on her thighs like she was performing an autopsy on the device, which I figured she was, since it seemed doubtful she would ever be able to put it back together. But then she began to do just that, reassembling the QCOM in seconds with the speed and dexterity of a Marine field-stripping a weapon. When she finished putting it back together, she powered it on and watched the operating system reboot. Then she finally raised her eyes to meet mine. I pointed to the seat beside her. "Is it okay if I sit here? I know it's hard to believe, but I improvised this opening line right on the spot." She gave me a quick once-over before answering. "Sorry," she said. "I'm having a private conversation with my droid. Isn't that right, R2? She raised her flask to her lips again, then waved it at the seat of empty seats spread out below us. "Why don't you go find another female of the species to mac on?"
"Don't flatter yourself, Vasquez," I nodded at her flask. "I'm just here to bum some of your booze."
She laughed, and I felt a sharp pain in the center of my chest. She glanced down at her "El riesgo siempre vive" tattoo, clearly impressed that I knew its origin.
All right, she said with an amused sigh. Have a seat, babyface.
Thanks, Grandma. I took the seat next to her and propped my feet up on the seat back in front of me, like she was doing.
Did you just call me Grandma?
Yeah, because you just called me babyface, and it wounded my masculine pride. She laughed again, louder this time, increasing the intensity of my chest pains.
She was even more gorgeous up close, and her eyes, which I'd thought were brown, actually appeared to be more amber-colored, and her gold irises were shot through with streaks of copper.
Sorry, she said. You have a young face.
How old are you?
18 last month.
She smirked.
Too bad, she said. I kind of have a thing for jailbait.
Great, I said. A pedophile with a drinking habit.
That got a third laugh, a snorting, girlish chuckle that disrupted my heart rate yet again. Then she glanced back down at her flask and addressed it in a confidential tone.
R2, she muttered. This dream just keeps getting weirder. Now a cute, wisecracking boy has shown up in it. What are the odds?
I almost asked if she meant me. Disaster averted.
I hate to break it to you, I said, but you're not dreaming this.
I'm not? How can you be so sure?
Because I'm clearly the one who's dreaming all of this, I said. How could you be dreaming this when you're just another figment of my imagination like everyone else here?
Well, I hate to break it to you, she said, poking me with her flask and splashing some of its contents on my leg. But I am not a figment of anyone's imagination.
That's a relief, I thought. But what I actually said was,
unfortunately, neither am I.
Then I offered her a smile.
So all of this must really be happening right now, to both of us.
She nodded and took another drink.
Yeah, she said. That's what I was afraid of.
Then she held out her flask, finally offering me a drink, but I shook my head.
You know, on second thought, maybe I should keep a clear head for the briefing, I said.
Then, as if that weren't lame enough, I added, I'm not old enough to drink anyway.
She rolled her eyes at me.
They're about to tell us the world is ending, you realize? She said. You don't want to be stone-cold sober for that shit, do you?
You make a compelling argument, I said, taking the flask from her.
As I raised it to my lips, she began to chant,
Breaking the law, breaking the law.
I gave her a pleading look. Please, don't make me shoot this out my nose, okay? She nodded solemnly and raised three fingers.
Girl Scouts honor.
I rolled my eyes. I find it hard to believe that you were ever a Girl Scout. Her eyes narrowed. Then she reached out and rolled down her striped knee sock, revealing a dark green Girl Scouts of America logo tattooed on her left calf.
I stand corrected, I said.
Are you hiding any other cool tattoos?
She punched me in the shoulder, hard, then pointed at the flask still in my hand.
Quit stalling, babyface. Bottoms up.
I took a small sip, but I still swallowed enough of the burning liquid to make me wince and cough. I didn't know enough about liquor to discern what she had in there, but my guess would have been rocket fuel mixed with a finger or two of paint thinner. I knew she was still watching me, so I forced myself to choke down a second, longer drink. Then I passed the flask back to her, all smooth-like, even though my eyes were watering and my throat felt like I'd just downed a shot of molten lava.
Thank you,
I said hoarsely.
I'm Alexis Larkin. She stuck out her hand, but my friends call me Lex.
Nice to meet you, Lex. I felt a small static shock as we shook hands. I'm Zach. Zach Lightman, I said, stuttering through my own name.
She grinned and reached for the flask, which I gladly handed back to her.
So, where do you hail from, Zach Lightman?
It's just one Zach, I said, laughing. I'm from Portland, Oregon. What about you?
Texas, she said softly. I live in Austin. Her expression darkened, and she took another drink, wincing at this one.
And I was just there, less than an hour ago, debugging subroutines in my cubicle when a motherfucking Earth Defense Alliance shuttle suddenly shows up and lands right outside my office building.
I figured I must be losing it.
Now I'm not sure what to think.
She shivered and rubbed her bare shoulders.
It's cold as balls in here, she said, and I left my sweater in a different time zone.
I offered up a silent prayer of thanks to Crom, then opened my backpack and handed her my father's jacket.
Wow, she said, badass.
Thank you.
She spent a few seconds admiring the patches, then she drew the jacket across her shoulders like a shawl.
Where do you work?
At a software company. We make apps and operating systems for mobile devices. It was surreal when the shuttle landed outside our offices, because a lot of my coworkers are gamers too, so a lot of us recognized the shuttle right away, even before we saw the Earth Defense Alliance crest on its hull.
None of us could believe what we were seeing.
What happened? We all ran outside of the parking lot. Then two people wearing suits, a man and a woman, stepped out of the shuttle and asked for me by my full name, which was weirdly humiliating, like getting called to the principal's office or something. They said they needed my assistance with a matter of urgent national security. What was I supposed to do? They were riding around in a spaceship from a video game, and I knew I couldn't spend the rest of my life wondering what it looked like on the inside or where it was going to take me, so I went with them. She nodded at our surroundings. Now I'm in a top-secret government base somewhere in the middle of fucking Iowa waiting to find out what the hell is happening. In short, I'm totally losing my shit. She said all of this in a very calm, steady voice. I nodded. I think we're actually somewhere in the middle of fucking Nebraska.
Yeah, how do you know?
Because Ray, the EDA agent who brought me here, said this was Nebraska. The jokers who brought me here wouldn't tell me shit, she said. It hadn't occurred to me until now that I may have been given special treatment, but it seemed doubtful that all of the other recruit candidates in that auditorium had been mentored and watched over by an undercover EDA agent who had been stationed in their hometown for the past 6 years. Lex glanced back down at her QCOM, which had finished rebooting, and thumbed through the icons on its display.
They better make good on their promise to unlock these things, she said. I don't want my grandma to get too worried about me. She tends to do that if I don't call her every day.
Lex dialed a number on the QCOM from memory, but a red X appeared on the display, along with a message that said, access to civilian networks locked.
We'll see about that, she muttered, scowling at the QCOM before she slid it into her pocket.
Are you and your grandma close? I asked, just to hear her talk some more. She nodded.
My folks both died in a car crash when I was little. My grandpa had already passed, so my grandma raised me by herself.
She met my gaze. How about you, Zach? Anyone back at home you're worried about? Anybody who'll be worried about you? I nodded. My mom. I pictured her face. She's a nurse. It's just the two of us.
Lex nodded as if I'd explained everything. We both fell silent for a moment.
I suddenly found myself wishing Cruz and Deal were there with me. The insanity of this experience would have been much easier to handle with my two best friends around. But even though the Mikes were skilled at both Terra Firma and Armada, their rankings apparently weren't high enough in either game to merit an invitation to these strange proceedings.
Lex? Zach? Do you play Terra Firma and Armada?
TF.
How good are you at it? I asked. Are you one of the 30 dozen?
She nodded.
I'm currently ranked 17th, she said, far too nonchalantly. But I've been as high as 15th. Those standings fluctuate a lot.
I whistled low, impressed. Damn, woman, I said. What's your call sign?
Lexicutioner, she said. It's a portmanteau. What's yours?
Iron Beagle, I told her, wincing at how dorky it sounded in my ears.
It's fantastic, she said. I love that flick, as cheesy as it is. And my grandma used to play that Snoopy versus the Red Baron album every Christmas.
I did a double take at her. No one had ever gotten the Iron Eagle Peanuts mashup in my call sign without me first having to explain it to them, including Cruz and Deal. I felt a strong urge to reach out and touch her shoulder to confirm that she was real.
You're not in the 30 dozen, otherwise I'd recognize your call sign, she said. You must play Armada?
I nodded, trying to hide my disappointment.
Not your game?
She shook her head.
Flight simulators give me vertigo.
I prefer to throw down with my feet on the ground. She pointed a thumb at herself. You put me at the controls of a giant battle mech, I will crush my enemies.